I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran, and this is Radio versus the Martians. So a couple weeks ago, Mike, I went to the Living Computer Museum with Elliot and Felix. It was just me, so I was juggling kids all the time. Mm-hmm. But do you know what this is?
No.
It's like a museum that's in Soto. I think it's Microsoft money that put it. I'm pretty sure it's just Microsoft money that put it together. But they have a bunch of sort of the history of computing. They just have actual functional working machines that you can go and like interface with, and some of them are like, oh, there's this esoteric mainframe from the 70s or something, and they give you nice little placards where maybe you can execute some code or something. And of course they have like, you know, like, oh, there's a PC from the late 90s and there's CD-ROMs that you can just sort of load up and play like Age of Empires or something. So part of it's a nostalgia kick. There is an extra bit of nostalgia kick because what do they call it when they add to a museum? It's a special exhibit, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
That was like, oh, it's like the 80s revisited. And this was, they had sort of taken this one corner and they'd sort of sliced out. We kind of felt like you were in a diorama. It kind of felt like they were intentionally making this weird little place inside of a museum that was a warp back to complete nostalgia overload. So one of them was what looked to be like a classroom where they just had Apple II computers on the desk, and there was a overhead machine that had, you know, like a transparency on it that showed you how to like type in all these Apple IIs, like 9 or 10 of them that worked. Next to it, they basically had like a mini 80s arcade that was also sort of dingy and dark, and the walls were painted black and everything, and they had so working Joust and Asteroids and Tempest games there, and even they even had a token machine that had a button on it, and you push the button and it would give you $1 worth of tokens. And then next to this, it was the ultimate nostalgia geek out, where it was basically a late 70s, early 80s decked out living room, complete with period furniture, music, like records on the shelf, an Amiga, I think it was a Texas Instruments computer on the desk, and then in front of the couch there was a CRT television with like an Atari 2600 and an NES. You could just plop yourself on the floor, swap out games, and play it while it was there.
Oh.
So part of that was like, oh, that's so special. And then part of it is just like nostalgia is great, but like we're not there anymore.
No.
I don't know why I felt that my initial reaction was sort of like, this is magical, and then my next reaction is, this doesn't exist anymore, and
no,
we can't live there.
Well, you don't want to live there anymore. I think one of the things that'll be interesting, also considering that you brought your sons there, is that what is this to them? I mean, comparatively to what this would be to you, what is that equivalent? And that's like something from the 1950s to them.
Yes, that's true.
And
it's like Back to the Future.
It is Back to the Future. That is their Back to the Future, which is, that is a weird, quaint time that they're not going to see the magic in because it wasn't part of their childhood.
Yeah.
They're just like, why can't I get on the internet? Why does this only play one game? Why is there only one button on this Atari controller? And that,
I think I just accidentally fingered my cat's asshole there for a second. I wasn't trying to, Sully, I swear.
Oh, we just became a very different show. But
sorry, my cat just keeps interrupting us there. If the listeners don't know, but the beautiful Valverde has only one indigenous species, and that's a common house cat by the name of Sully,
who lives under the bed most of the time and then comes out at weird moments where you forget that he exists, and then you're like, oh, there's a cat. But speaking of the Back to the Future thing, when that movie first came out and they were showing test audiences that movie, they got a very different generational reaction to it. One of them from people who had been alive in the 50s and had nostalgia for the time, and people who were young, who were the Marty McFly generation. And what they found is that to people watching the movie who were older, they go, oh my God, I remember that. And I know what that is. And oh my God, that's so awesome. And for younger people, it's like a nightmare. You're like, what is happening? Why is everything like this? Why are you going to high school and you're wearing a tie?
Oh my god.
I mean, it's that kind of thing. And that tie doesn't even have keyboard on it. What are we doing?
But well, by the time you do Back to the Future 2, where they replicate that experience by going forward to the far-flung year of 2015, mm-hmm. I love it that it's Elijah, like young Elijah Wood in the 80s retro cafe, and there's Nintendo's gunman.
Wild gunman
that Marty McFly is awesome at it because he's obviously played it forever. And then Elijah Wood, or the kid he's next to, says, "You have to use your hands. This is a baby toy."
Yeah. It actually, for all the things that future got wrong, like fax machines being a massive thing and Jaws 9 and flying cars, the stuff that it did get right is this nostalgia for the 1980s.
Yeah, this is true.
That was actually true. Pretty prescient. And that one of my favorite things that movie did, which was make fun of nostalgia by making fun of what was at that time the present.
Right.
And having this weird sort of crazy Max Headroom Cafe.
Yeah, speaking of Max Headroom Cafe, wasn't it Ronald Reagan as Max Headroom?
Yeah, and the Ayatollah.
Yes, if they need to have a reboot of Max Headroom, that is instead Max Headroom, it's Ronnie Headroom.
Yeah.
That would be great. I don't know what he does, solve crimes, help people solve crimes, I guess.
He gets you a Pepsi.
Yes.
And is taking away a job from somebody who would otherwise be a server, apparently. I'm trying to figure out how that diner works, because if you notice that there is AI that takes your orders and serves you food.
Sure.
I don't know if there's a waiter. I think there may be a waitress that's walking around.
It's like an automat, you know. There's people behind the wall, that sort of thing.
There's also people that are on stationary bicycles pedaling that seem to be powering something. Like, I don't know if they're actually powering the Ronald Reagan animatronic character, but at one point, they stop, and Griff yells at them, "Don't stop pedaling, you two!" And I'm like,
"Wait, in the Back to the Future, do they have abundant fusion energy, or do they just have beautiful clean coal like we have right now?"
They take the coal, they clean it off. I don't know what they do. I mean, because obviously the real game changer.
Oh, right. The fusion. They've Mr. Fusion.
Mr. Fusion.
So obviously if all households have their own little fusion reactor that you can put bananas and beer in.
Well, yeah. That is the thing that would change everything. More than the internet, I think Mr. Fusion would pretty much end global warming.
Yes, it would.
It would basically end all pollution because there's no such thing as trash anymore. All it is fuel. Everything is fuel.
People would be putting bodies into. I think the first thing they'd have to do is make sure that they only make them small, keep them small, so people just wouldn't be dumping, you know, just wouldn't be pushing their neighbor over into their fusion device.
But even then, the hacksaw was invented a long time ago.
And I'm just imagining the wood chipper thing from Fargo.
There's a lot of guys in New Jersey in tracksuits that already know how to solve that problem.
That's what I loved about Looper is that the idea was that time travel as a thing could be something that was like would open up new worlds or experiences. They were just like, it's just the most efficient way to get rid of a body.
It is. That guy doesn't exist back there. It's crazy. But yeah, the uses of time travel, I think most of them would be awful. I mean,
it depends on how you're doing it. Are you doing it where the effects that you have on time travel irrevocably change your present when you go back to your present, or do you just split off on a new timeline when you're just in a new timeline where it happened that you traveled to that timeline, and so you're not really worrying about getting back to your own house and like the sky being filled with pterodactyls?
So in your own timeline, do you just disappear one day?
You do.
Or are you replaced by another you?
Oh, interesting.
Because I mean, in Back to the Future 2, Marty McFly goes back to 1985, but it's a version of 1985 that's been altered by Biff Tannen. Is there another him? Because remember, when he shows up at Biff's casino, they say, "You're supposed to be in Switzerland, you little punk." So basically,
you've seen this more recently than I have, because I think it's been at least 15 years.
It hasn't been that long for me, but it's been a few years.
Yeah.
I love Back to the Future. So there is an alternate version of Marty McFly that existed in that timeline, who is kind of like a reprobate, awful person that they sent away to some Switzerland boarding school.
Right.
So when our Marty jumped to that alternate timeline, did that other Marty disappear? Or did that other Marty also have adventures with Doc Brown?
It's got to be like Time Cop, man. You know, they're both in the same place, but they can never touch.
Yeah, but again, you have Marty McFly and Doc are in 2015 when the timeline is changed around them. So if they'd stayed in 2015, would they stay in the 2015 that they traveled to, or would it have changed around them into a dystopian Biff altered 2015? We don't know because they never...
I think you're locked in. I think you're locked in to where you are unless you leap out, right?
And then Biff jumped back to them.
Oh, that's right.
So does Biff not get to see the fruits of his own labor? So that had to change around them, but their own memories don't change.
That sounds like hell.
I mean, there's enough hell that we never actually deal with because there's so much forward momentum in those movies. So Marty McFly, in the very first movie, goes back in time, alters the way that his parents meet, alters the nature of this parent's relationship, alters both of his parents' personalities so that in 1985, his mother's no longer a drunk, his dad is more assertive and is a published science fiction author, mm-hmm. and they're both happier and healthier. They still live in the same house, but it's cleaner. And
they were destined for that real estate.
Where his older brother worked at Burger King before, and now he works at an office building.
Right.
That everyone is happier. Anyone is more successful in a 1980s kind of way, including Marty getting that pickup truck that he wants. So we still have Marty McFly as the lead character who has all the memories of that previous life.
Oh, that's true.
And he's jumped back in, and before he has a chance to sort of reintegrate himself into this world where there are events of his life in this timeline that he does not know and went totally different. Who knows if he's a very different person? What if he's all sorts of things different because he was raised by fundamentally different people now.
Right. And they don't, and essentially since Marty McFly is your POV character, he still has the memory of everything that happened before changes in the timeline were made. And at the end of the first one, he can remember, as soon as he gets back, he can still remember all the crazy shit that he had to do to get his parents back together again. Mm-hmm. So you imagine he just remains, his brain, his memories remains fundamentally unchanged.
Yeah.
So he is a visitor, a replacement, a doppelganger from a different timeline is what he is.
So
yes,
it's like,
absolutely.
So Biff Tannen, the Biff Tannen that goes from 2015, he's like a 70-year-old Biff Tannen, goes back in time to 1955, gives a sports almanac to his younger 17-year-old self. And that 17-year-old self would later become a millionaire and like a crime boss with a bad Trump hair who murders George McFly at one point and marries Lorraine Baines McFly. And that whole series of experiences and all the money that he gained and all the time being a young person having this money, when old Biff jumps back to the future, he has none of those memories.
Yeah,
he just gets to be a really, really old rich guy. He doesn't get to be a young rich guy. He doesn't have any of those memories. But his alternate self, who disappears from that point in time where older self jumped back in time.
There must have been real disappointment in older Biff. He probably thought, since obviously Biff is not smart enough to know anything about temporal causality, he probably was like, well, I'll just leap back and everything will be great. And he probably leapt back and he was the same.
Well,
he would leap back into the fractured timeline. Right?
Yeah, he would still go back to a time where he's really rich.
Right.
But he's old and he wouldn't be able to enjoy it as well.
He will have lived like 30 plus years in humiliation and...
Yeah, who knows what he doesn't get to actually experience being a rich 20-year-old. He has the memory of being this emasculated guy who was beaten up on basically the night of a dance by the guy that he bullied. And then through the next 20, 30 years, being basically forced to be that guy's butler and waxing his car. And who knows if he's even prevented the birth of his grandson in this new one. Who knows if Griff even exists in this timeline. I mean, figuring out the timeline of who Griff's parents are and the fact that at some point Biff has kids and it has to be something where his grandkids are of the same age as Marty. There's a lot of stuff. Was Biff married in 1985 with kids?
Yeah, I would imagine he probably was.
They treat him as if he's like a single guy. See, that's the stuff that it'll drive you mad. but he doesn't get to enjoy any of that the same way that Marty doesn't, because the world changes around him, but he doesn't change. But Marty basically gets to go back, and his new happier life is him as a 17-year-old with a brand new car and a girlfriend that his mother now approves of.
Is that this is like it's like eternal punishment for finite crimes here. It really does feel like Biff is being cast into hell and he can't be redeemed.
No, he's right? Like an awful person. I think this is a Walter White sort of situation. Okay. That I think that...
I mean, he is an awful person, but is there redemption for Biff?
Not really. I don't think so. No. I mean, he seems like he's less dumb as an old man.
Yeah.
Young to middle-aged Biff is a very stupid person, but I think he got some level of brains over time, mostly just from aging, which is why he knows that his younger self that, you know, maybe why don't you make like a tree and get out of here? He knows that that's fucking stupid and smacks his younger self. And he says, you sound like a damn fool when you say it wrong. So it's,
there's clearly, of course, there's clearly shades of the pithy thing about, like, you always sort of become your parents. And so you sort of get the sense that old Biff is basically what Biff's father was.
Yeah.
And so he ages out of being stupid, and his only way of dealing with it is, like, taking his own son or his grandson and then abusing him in exactly yeah. the same way.
And creating an even crazier grandson. Yeah. But the thing is...
Yeah, there is something cracked about Griff that is not present with Biff, right?
But he also is like a cyborg. Because remember they said he's got some short circuits in his bionic implants.
Right.
I don't know what's going on there. There's a lot of weird stuff with that future. But so he, when you look at just the timeline of Biff, the original Biff in the first movie is a guy who works at the same crappy office job that George McFly does. And he's like his supervisor. And bullies him the same way they did it in high school and gets yep. him to do his reports for him.
Yep.
So it's the same exact dynamic. But then, after time travel, after Marty goes back in time and changes the trajectory of their lives with a new timeline, where, given an opportunity, we know now that Biff is an attempted rapist, that he wasn't in the original timeline. Just as, you know, the new timeline that he creates reveals that Biff is a potential murderer. We didn't know that. It's, again, the Walter White thing, that it's right. a question of that potential is always there. He was just never given the opportunity to do that. But that sort of shit's still going on in his head.
But this is a pre-crime thing. Come on. You don't want to give him a eternal punishment for him that potentially having those committing those crimes, right?
But it seems like he's got a better life after Marty tampers with the timeline in the first movie, because he goes from working a crappy office job where he makes his victim do all his work for him into being a small business owner. Where he's got an auto detailing company. It's not just that he works there. His name is on there, and he's got matchbooks.
That was probably a small price to pay, right? His balls was yeah. a small price
but
to pay.
But he also doesn't get to retire.
Financial independence.
He's still doing that auto-detailing shit he has no retirement. Because he's like 77 in the future.
Not in 2015. There's
no.
There's no union.
It's so prescient.
In 2015.
He's living in the gig economy.
Your Social Security has been privatized. Sorry.
Yeah, so this old man, or the version of Biff that goes back in time in the second movie, is the version who was beaten up by George McFly.
Right.
And is also apparently just terrified of him in person, because you notice in the third movie, when Marty finally gets back to his 1985, Biff is waxing his car, but sees him pick up that can and gets up, hey, butthead, what are you doing? Oh, hey, Marty. It's like, oh, crap. George is going to beat me up again if he knows I yelled at his kid. He's got this sort of secret identity. He's still a terrible person, but he's terrified. Who knows how often George kicks this guy's ass?
Maybe that's just the prescription we need for the current ages. Maybe bullies just need to be afraid constantly.
Yeah.
Is there a lesson to be, a sociological lesson to be learned from the emasculation of Biff Tannen?
Yeah, but again, if you look at the reversal, George is a much better tormentor because he's friendly to Biff. And the most he can say, oh, Biff, you character, always trying to get away with right. something, raping my wife in high school, trying to, before I kicked his ass. Because it's like, I don't know if this is like the ultimate revenge, because I certainly wouldn't want to be re-victimized every time my attempted rapist came by to wax my husband's car, his BMW, in front of the house. But maybe there is something worth there where you can watch this person who tried to hurt you in a very visceral, deep way, watching him get emasculated and scraping and bowing in front of you. Watch this son of a bitch brought low.
Wait, isn't this in the Red Sun comic book? Isn't this the way Superman deals with the bad guys? Superman team. So Red Sun is, for listeners that don't know, is the Elseworlds sort of one-shot story where Superman falls into Soviet Union and he becomes basically the symbol of
communism.
He becomes a symbol of global hope, but through the lens of Joseph Stalin's communism, essentially.
Like the best version of that kind of communist world.
Right. And his sort of foil is, of course, Lex Luthor, who's the American president, and he's the smartest guy alive. But the thing is it's, Superman's sort of beacon of hope creates momentum for communism as a global sort of hegemonic force to come and take over the world because, we've got Superman behind us. We've got the moral authority behind us. And the way that, Stalin would just purge his sort of political enemies, but Superman will not allow that to happen. So in some ways, Superman, I think Brainiac comes and he defeats Brainiac and he enslaves Brainiac and they use Brainiac's mind control powers to make all of the former enemies of the state, as well as Superman's former enemies, basically mindless automatons to help them continue taking over the world.
Oh, see, that's way better. That's way better than just killing people.
Is that okay?
No.
Just erase your personality.
It isn't like Superman beat them up and now they're waxing his car. I'm just putting a second coat on it, Mr. Kal-El. And he's like wiping down that giant key from the Fortress of Solitude. He's like,
No, I mean, well, there's the question. Is it better to have to relive the humiliation over and over again, or just have your personality wiped out so you're pretty much okay with it?
Oh, well, are you really you?
If it's going to be for the rest of your natural life, and I'm sure that Biff, like you saw him in Back to the Future 2, he's humiliated, he's a broken man, so broken that he's willing to destroy the whole timeline to get his revenge.
But that other personality is still under there. It's just kept in check.
Right.
That, remember, he still yells at Marty, then he recognizes, oh my god, it's the boss's kid. He turns around like on a dime, and it's crazy. So that's the weird thing, is that Marty never stays around in the new 1985 long enough to realize how much has changed, other than the ways that benefit him in the very short term. He may have a completely different relationship with all sorts of people, that apparently still has a rival with Needles, who wants to race him.
Red Hot Chili Peppers flee.
Yes.
You're right. We don't see new 1985 very much at all. Like when you're there for a little bit and then you go forward and then, of course, by the time you come back to 1985, everything's screwed up. Timeline's screwed up and it's totally different. I suppose there's also at the very end of 3, you see it again, but that's just the end.
That's just the end. And you don't see very much of it. But again, it seems like there's a lot of rules that don't always work consistently. So the version of 2015 that Marty and Doc are in when the timeline is changed, because they are stranded there very briefly, but they don't know that they're stranded. Mm-hmm. And Biff takes the time machine, goes back in time, gives the almanac to his younger self, comes back, leaves the time vehicle there. So the timeline has changed around Marty and Doc, yet they don't have the memory of coming from like a hellhole version of 1985.
Right.
Yet he does say when they leave Jennifer behind in Hellhole 1985 that don't worry, it'll change around her and she'll have left with no memory of this terrible place.
Oh. Is that just because she was unconscious when the change happens?
Yeah. Maybe because she was unconscious. She just slept through the hellhole. But to leave her sleeping in the middle of nowhere.
Can I do that? Can I just take some tranquilizers and wake up and...
Yeah, don't use a future device to knock out your girlfriend and then leave her in a really bad neighborhood sleeping on a bench on her own porch.
Right.
That's going to end badly.
Is Back to the Future the best time travel movie so far that's been made so far? There are great movies that do have time travel as a part of them, but
mm-hmm. Well, the Terminator is really good.
Yeah.
But the time travel is, I mean, it's not from the perspective of the time traveler. I mean, you see a bit of the future, but this is not Kyle Reese's movie. It's Sarah Connor's movie.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the main character is George McFly rather than Marty McFly. That you're the person who lives in the present, and the future people are messing with things to try to change things. I don't know. So I'd say time travel is the thing that puts the pieces on the board for Terminator, but I don't know if I'd call it a time travel movie. Planet of the Apes is a time travel movie, but for most of it, you don't know that it's a time travel movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know that you just think he's in the far future on a different planet.
Right. I mean, Looper, obviously, that's a very recent one. I think, oh shit.
Could you say that It's a Wonderful Life is a time travel movie?
That's an alternate reality. Well.
It's about changing something that happened in the past.
Is A Christmas Carol a time travel movie?
It kind of is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's seeing a possible future if he goes along this specific past. He does go back to the past and sees past versions of himself to try to recapture these feelings of who he used to be before greed sort of stomped it out. So it is. I mean, I don't know.
There was a small movie called Primer that was essentially sort of like the thinking man's time travel movie about two, I don't know if you've seen it, two engineering students who discover a way to create time travel, and they're very cognizant of not fucking up the timeline in the way that they do it, and both try to prevent bad things from happening or do good things for themselves, and strange shit ends up happening. It's a fantastic movie, but only one of those types of movies that someone who is sort of steeped in the idea of causality, I think, could watch it and understand. Because even the first time through, I was like, there was a few things. Oh, okay, I get it.
There's only so many paths you can have on a time travel movie. So it's like, meet your parents, make money, kill Hitler.
Right.
I mean, there's not a lot.
The top three.
The top three. But then you have something like How Time Travel Works in Lost.
Yeah.
Which is a mindfuck because it makes you think. If you think about it and you follow the way that time works in Lost to its logical conclusion, it's an existential nightmare because it's also contradictory to the themes of the show, the idea of getting a second chance and that you can make choices and change who you are. So in Lost, the characters in season 5 do travel back in time to the 70s and a bunch of other places too. But what we learn is that time travel always happens. There's one timeline, and you cannot change it.
Hmm.
So if you do travel back to the 1950s and do something, you're not changing anything. You had always been part of the timeline, that you were always destined to go back in time, and always destined to make those choices. And you can't change anything because every choice you made is a choice you already made. So it's this like hardened in amber timeline.
Well, I've seen this trope before. I think the H.G. Wells Time Machine is at least the Guy Pearce version.
Mm-hmm.
Guy Pearce version adopted this as a... I've seen this time travel trope. I don't know where it comes from. The idea where the universe resists change.
Mm-hmm.
Where if something was destined to happen, you can go back and try to change it, but it will always happen. It will recur. And that is a recurring time travel trope. Is there are just some things you can't change.
You can't change it.
Yeah.
And the thing with Lost too, and this is that actually happens in Lost, is a character called Desmond who seems to be this kind of one person who's kind of an odd outlier, that he can change things, but they snap back. That the universe resists him making changes. So the thing with this though is if there's one timeline and you can't change anything, well, you're technically always traveling in time. You're always moving forward.
Right.
So you have no free will. If my traveling back in time in the future was preordained, then I had no choice but to travel back in the future. So I just have no choice, period.
Mike, I hate to break it to you, but the universe is deterministic. So you just have no choice at all. Time traveler, no.
Yeah, and so you really can't change anything. All you really do is get yourself into a lot of old photographs.
Yeah, well, you get some tourism is what it is. And if I were to have a complete speculative industry that I would start, it would be time travel tourism. Like, you just like, so you want to spend 6 days in like the 19th century England or something? Like, let's do it.
But is that how Jack the Ripper happened?
that's not how I would have done it, but. I think that would be a great premise for a movie or a TV show, maybe even a TV show. But the idea being is that like the changes you make don't roll forward at all.
What if everyone is tripping over each other because everybody's trying to kill Hitler?
Yes, those are just like 3 days in 1945 that are just like the most traveled.
Like half of the people in Berlin are tourists wearing a stolen German uniforms, yes, trying to get closer, but they're all sort of stepping on each other's plots.
You know, like, well, there's a lot of time. You know, very few people would be going back to, you know, like 5 billion years ago. So you could go there pretty safely and hang out for a while. It wouldn't be as interesting, though.
It's like if somebody goes back in time and they're won over by Hitler. It's like, that's who Goebbels is or something. He was like originally a tourist from the future who went back to kill him, but it just ended up being making him worse.
Well, it has to be the sort of thing where you have a... Your return trip happens automatically.
Yeah.
As you know, after X number of hours, you're going to come back.
You're going to come back. Unless,
so you can't live there.
You can't live there.
But
then, I don't know. It seems like it'd be a lot harder to kill Hitler than it would be just to go back in time and be his friend and convince him to stay in art school. It just seems like that's an easier thing. Give him some money. Just say it's like the world gets another mediocre painter.
The thing is if you can choose whatever time you wanted to do, the more efficacious thing would be to do the Sarah Connor thing, which is just kill Hitler's mom. But the thing is that as a thing for you to do on vacation wouldn't be as satisfying. You'd be like, oh, okay, so I killed this woman. No, clearly it would be getting Hitler in your scope sights and, you know, just like turning his head into salsa, right?
Yeah.
That would be what you would want to do.
Yeah.
Because we're not talking about making permanent changes here.
Yeah, it's weird, but then you get into the sort of question...
I don't know, but would you even want... If there wasn't even the result of you preventing terrible things from happening, why would you want to do it, though? Other than this, I guess you could have some satisfaction of being, killing the most evil man in history.
I mean, there'd be if you couldn't change the timeline, you're just splitting off all these timelines, and all you're doing is creating all of these universes where Hitler gets shot in the head.
You're making some good universes.
Yeah, I think that's better.
This is true.
And you know, I wouldn't say I'm a pacifist, but I certainly don't want to kill anybody. But I wouldn't feel bad about shooting Hitler.
I guess, well, here's the thing is, of course, since you're going back in time, it's not like the holodeck. There are no holodeck safeties. You can die.
You can die.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's sort of weird.
So that would make me terrible because I would not be able to survive.
So there is an old issue of Marvel 2-in-1. I don't know if you are familiar with this series.
No.
Marvel in the 1970s did team-up books where they would have one recurring character and one guest character. One of the examples, the most famous one, is Marvel Team-Up, which was a book where it was always Spider-Man as the lead character because he's obviously one of Marvel's most popular flagship characters.
Sure.
And every month he would team up with a different Marvel character. Sometimes it was like a big name like Captain America or, you know, like Nightcrawler of the X-Men or somebody who'd be really popular. But a lot of the time it would be this weird kind of side character, a little minor character. He'd team up with like Son of Satan or Luke Cage or Howard the Duck or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also a neat way to, one, keep their copyrights updated, their trademarks, but also it was kind of a little tour into the greater Marvel universe.
Sure.
Marvel 2-in-1 did the exact same model, except instead of Spider-Man, it was Ben Grimm, the Thing from Fantastic Four.
Oh, interesting.
And one of the issues of Marvel 2-in-1 is called it's Marvel 2-in-1 starring The Thing and The Thing. And in this story, Ben Grimm finds out that there is a cure to him being The Thing. The problem is he's been The Thing so long that this new cure wouldn't work on him, but it would work on his younger self shortly after he became The Thing. So, you know, the version of The Thing we all recognize is sort of the big orange rocky guy.
Yep.
But when he was first around in the comics, he was sort of drawn like he was made out of like hardened oatmeal. He was lumpy. And so Ben Grimm gets in a time machine and goes back in time. But he finds out that he can't actually change his timeline, that if he cures this other Ben Grimm, he's not going to become a human again. But he can make this other Ben Grimm's life a lot better. Hmm. And he chooses to do that. He gets into a fight with his younger self who does not recognize him. And is sort of angrier and just in this, holy crap, I'm a monster kind of mindset. And he gives him the cure. And after he leaves, that guy turns back into a human and gets to live the rest of his life not being, you know, a self-hating monster.
That totally reminds me, do you recall a very late, maybe season 6 or 7 episode of The Next Generation about Alexander Rodchenko coming back as an adult and trying to fix basically the same thing, trying to fix himself, trying to not make himself such a coward because he let Worf die, like mm-hmm. Worf dies in a fight or something and Alexander is like frozen. But I think that's as potentially that movie, that show of Star Trek rivals The Visitor, which is, I think, the DS9 one about Jake Sisko.
Oh, that's a great episode.
Seeing himself grow old and trying to fix him.
Where he's a novelist.
Yeah.
And he knows that his dad's going to pop back into this timeline at some point.
That is probably the most emotional one. But certainly this one is great because the idea that you get to see Alexander Rodchenko as an adult, who's played by James Sloyan, by the way, which is the scientist that has Odo's scientist.
Oh.
Same actor. But you have that moment where it's like, you know, Worf's been dead for many, many years, and this is something that's kind of ruined Alexander's life, and he's always thought, like, well, he's blamed himself. Why was I not a better Klingon, right? Why was I not able to jump in and save him? And you have the moment where he finally gets to, like, reveal to Worf, don't you recognize me? I'm your son. And there is, like, this palpable wave of emotions that happened between the two of them where it would be like, now I recognize that you're my son and all the love that I have between you is still there. And he gets to see his father again. Like, and he gets to also, his father knows that it's him. Like, part of that exchange, and the actors did it extremely well, like Michael Dorn and James Sloyan did it, like, very well. But I love that idea of having the, creating the tension around being like the, this is what I would do with my time travel. You know, this is exactly what I would want to experience. And then to do it as a character beat, as a character arc, is great. It's fantastic.
You get some of that, too, with Cyclops of the X-Men and Cable.
Oh, yeah.
Though I think that was a retroactive continuity that I don't know how familiar you are with X-Men continuity. By the way, it's a fucking slog.
Well, I do know that Cyclops is Cable's father, right?
Yeah, so yeah. Cyclops in the early 80s got married to a woman named Madeline Pryor, and they had a son named Nathan Charles Christopher. And
it's Charles named after Charles Xavier?
Yeah, I think Nathan is Jean Grey's dad or something. There's a lot there's a lot of names going in there. No, because Christopher is the name of Cyclops' dad, who is a space pirate.
Okay.
Yes.
Sure. Thank you, comic books.
Yeah. It's just go with it. It's X-Men. So, basically, he's got this baby, and because he has a kid, Cyclops retires from being a superhero and goes to live in Alaska with his wife.
Sure.
And then they, of course, Marvel decides...
Are they next-door neighbors with the Rikers?
Probably. So Cyclops is retired for a while until Marvel decides they want to reunite the original X-Men characters together in a book called X-Factor. And this is the point where a lot of people kind of turn their backs on Cyclops because he finds out that Jean Grey, who he thought he had died many years earlier, is alive again. And then he abandons his wife and son in Alaska to go meet his dead ex in New York City. By the time he gets back, his wife is missing and their kid. He doesn't understand what's going on. But they're just kind of like, well, fuck you.
Not the moral beacon we thought he was, right?
Also, for a long time in that comic, he does not tell Jean that he's married and has a kid. Like, he's afraid to tell her. And everyone on the team knows it, and they're like, Scott, you should tell her you're being a jerk.
I think Cyclops is a douchebag.
He can be, certainly. this is one of the best examples of it. And so eventually, I forget what it goes, his wife ends up hanging out with the X-Men for a while. Then she becomes possessed by a demon and becomes the Goblin Queen.
As you do.
As part of a demon intervention thing in New York City. She dies. And Cyclops sort of gets his son back and is just kind of traveling around with the original X-Men, going on adventures, and he's got his son, who, even though he's prepubescent, has sort of developed this little force field power, which is weird. It's not always consistent how mutation works in comics. But then the character of Cable is introduced, and at first, there's no intention for Cable to be this kid from the future. I don't even know if they say that he's from the future. He's just like a badass dude with a giant gun and blue shoulder pads that is leading the New Mutants. And then they do a story, and I think this is when they made that decision. The bad guy Apocalypse, who was played in a crappy movie by a great actor named Oscar Isaac.
This is true.
Kidnaps Cyclops' son, because there's this huge elaborate plot where I don't even know how Mr. Sinister fits into this, but he ran a secret orphanage that was really sort of a weird science project.
Sure, of course.
And had been trying to get Cyclops to have kids that would be destined to kill Apocalypse, who technically turned him into Mr. Sinister. It's really kind of hazy, and I haven't read these in a long time. But Jean dies, so... Madeline Pryor is a clone of Jean who just doesn't have superpowers until she becomes the Goblin Queen and gets demon powers.
There's a few threads that I've already lost.
See, that's what I'm...
But go on.
And so...
So Cable eventually gets retroactively...
So I guess the way they wrote it, I don't know if they intended it at the time, so Cyclops' son, his infant son, is kidnapped by Apocalypse. I think because he knows that this kid is destined to kill him in the future. Injects him with what's called a techno-organic virus.
Cool.
And it's killing him. It's like turning him like half cyborg. It looks a lot like what happens to Tetsuo. You know, where he's just like nice. Growing onto him. And of course, Cyclops, they defeat Apocalypse and get the kid back, but he's like dying and turning half cyborg monster. And this lady comes from the future, like Kyle Reese style, out of like a light that appears in the wall, and she walks through and she says that she can cure him, but she has to take him in the future and he can never come back.
Oh, I thought she was just going to ask for, you know, like 40 years worth of back child support pay.
Oh,
never mind.
But she takes the kid and then disappears. And I think this is the point where they realize that this is Cable. The writers at least decided. I don't think they said for sure until a few years later, because at the same time, Cable has an evil twin named Strife, who wears this outfit that's like made out of knives, and he has a giant cape. And at the end,
was this prior to Spawn or after Spawn?
This is prior to Spawn, okay. I think. Yes, because they hadn't formed. Because he was created by Rob Liefeld, and Rob Liefeld was one of the founders of Image Comics.
Oh, okay.
So, there's two Cables basically. One is evil and wears a costume made out of knives and cape, and another one who is like, I'm a crazy guy with the big shoulder pads. And I think they were going to originally reveal that Strife was Cyclops' son and that Cable is a failed clone of him.
Okay.
And then they just chickened out and just made Cable his son. So the fucked up nature of the movies for the X-Men and the fact that continuity is a mess where you can go back in time and a character played by Bill Duke is now played by Peter Dinklage, which I'm not sure you can do with a time machine. But, I mean, it makes the fact that the timeline of the X-Men movies is so fucked up and incomprehensible the most accurate to the source material aspect of those films.
Okay.
Now recite back to me what I just said.
I can't. We need to see a picture of Strife because it sounds like a 90s thing.
Oh, Strife, by the way, his name is spelt with a Y.
Oh, of course it is.
Strife.
Wow, we when Ellie and I were on a road trip, we stopped by like a burger stand or something, and they had a in the burger stand they had someone had taken an old IKEA bookshelf. And the community and or the schools had basically been like, oh, here are free books, which is great. I mean, our block has like three of them, two of them within like a 2-block radius, little free libraries where people donate the books that they aren't going to read. It's great. It's a great idea. You don't need to sell them to Amazon. Just let your neighbors read them. And they had a section for comic books. And I was like, oh, I'll get some comic books for them. This one had clearly been picked over more than a few times by people who knew what they were doing. And the one thing that I found that I was like, well, this looks interesting, was an issue of X-Factor.
Okay.
Or X-Force, excuse me.
X-Force.
X-Force from 1994 or something like that. And it was clearly one of those, they must have a word for it. It's something exciting has just happened, and then there's like a one or two issue break where the characters are sort of like dealing with it, and then something exciting happens. So it was basically, it's in the sort of peak era of like everything is extreme. It's like the whole thing looks like an air guitar, and plot threads of things that are alluded to that I have no idea. So I'm trying to read this to my 5-year-old son. None of it makes a whit of sense. And then the hook for this episode is that there's a guy from the future who is kidnapping people to basically make a violent television show, and he sucks in one of the X-Men.
Oh, is it Mojo? Is he the big... if it's Mojo, Mojo's great. He's a big, fat, yellow guy who has, like, spider legs.
It's not Mojo. It's not... Because Mojo was on the animated show.
Okay.
This is somebody else. This guy looks like a radical disc jockey from the future.
Because there was a guy called Adam X the Extreme. This came after my time, and I know that he rides like a skateboard.
The
and
Extreme.
And it's like
does he wear flannel?
He does. He wears flannel
no,
and a backwards,
no shit.
Backwards baseball cap and
You're
rides a
shitting
skateboard.
Me. You're shitting me.
I think his blood catches on fire. It's a little weird. But he was supposed to be super cool. I mean, he really is just a mutant version of Poochie, the rockin' dog.
Everything's okay. Oh my god! There's apparently the world is coming apart above us right now.
Okay,
this just sounds like the ceiling is going to cave in on us any moment.
Oh, the timeline is going to change around us. But don't worry, we won't remember,
and neither will you.
Radio versus the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Val Verde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music was written and performed by Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobias Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Dan Lombardo. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Your friend Faraday said that you were from the future. I need to know if he was telling the truth.
Dude, that's ridiculous.
What year were you born? What year?
1931.
You're 46?
Yeah. Yes, I am.
So you fought in the Korean War?
There's no such thing.
Who's the president of the United States?
All right, dude, we're from the future. Sorry.